Welcome to Now. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Aisha Khalid.
This week, some scientists say that we look the way we do because we had to fight to survive.
As we develop this ability to form a fist, we see an equal development in the robust-sustained strength of the most commonly struck portions of the face.
A new treatment offers hope for lung cancer sufferers.
We'll also hear about a new movie that tackles two tough subjects, love and cancer.
We'll visit a nonprofit that promotes science and creativity.
And what new games are coming to your cell phone?
All that plus a new short film looks at gender roles in the Filipino-American community.
That's all coming up on this edition of Now.
Some new research suggests that the human face evolved so that less would break when a rival punched it.
It's a much more violent explanation than the leading alternative, that our skulls changed to accommodate a diet of hard-to-chew foods.
As Steve Barragona tells us, the authors of this study say it suggests a pugilistic past where violence was key to our evolution.
Mike Morgan is a black belt in two martial arts, and he is training as an emergency medicine physician at the University of Utah.
Gives me firsthand experience with a lot of the end results of human violence and aggression.
Morgan says when people fight, they go for the face. In the new study in the journal Biological Reviews, he and his co-author note changes in the shape of our faces over the course of about 4 million years of evolution.
So look at the jawbone, the portion with the lower teeth. It gets bigger. If you look back towards the hinge of the jaw joint, you can kind of see that bone getting wider.
The bone under the eye socket gets stronger, too. These are all places that take a beating in a fight. Last year, the authors published a paper detailing how, at the same time, the fist has evolved into a better fighting weapon. Morgan says only humans fight with fists. Dogs bite, cats scratch, antelopes gore, but humans punch.
When you look back in some of our closest relatives, chimpanzees, gorillas, they actually can't form a fist.
Chimps hit and slap. But a punch hurts more than a slap because it delivers force to a smaller area, Morgan says.
If you have a better weapon, if you have a stronger weapon, you can theoretically win more mates.
Which means more chances to pass on your genes, which is what evolution is all about. And as the weapon got better, the new research proposes, so did the defense.
As we develop this ability to form a fist, we see an equal development in the robust sustained strength of the most commonly struck portions of the face.
All this suggests an extremely violent human evolutionary history.
At one point in time, it made sense for us to be aggressive and violent. It guaranteed the survival of our species.
That may be so, but Marshall University biologist Paul Constantino has not seen evidence of it.
You know, I've studied a lot of our fossils, and we don't have a high incidence of facial trauma.
Constantino says some of the changes Morgan describes could be protection from violence, but others make more sense as adaptations to a changing diet.
I'm not against the idea that violence had some role to play in the evolution of human facial structure. I just think to try to prescribe it to everything, including the hand, including the face, is sort of stretching it.
Meanwhile, Morgan promises the fight over the competing theories will end peacefully. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
So what do you think? Do you agree with this new study?
Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And if you would like to see video of Steve Barragona's story, log on to our webpage, www.voanews.com.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Our address there is at Now VOA Show.
Every year, nearly 1 million people die from lung cancer.
The World Health Organization expects the death rate to go up as more people take up cigarette smoking.
As VOA's Carol Pearson tells us, researchers might have made an important step toward controlling this disease and extending people's lives.
Cigarette smoking is responsible for most lung cancers. Studies have established that connection. Others have established that inhaling toxins from someone else's cigarettes can also cause the disease. Nearly 1 million people die from lung cancer every year. Another 600,000 die from secondhand smoke. And until recently, the treatment all patients received was the same chemotherapy. Sometimes it helped, but sometimes it didn't. Researchers have been trying to come up with better treatments to shrink the tumors without affecting normal tissue or subjecting patients to the negative side effects of chemotherapy. One new treatment relies on a test to identify damaged genes called oncogenes that allow cancer cells to grow and spread. Oncologist Mark Criss from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center led a study that examined the role oncogenes play in the spread of cancer.
That damaged gene makes certain proteins, and those proteins become absolutely critical to the growth of that cancer cell.
Dr. Criss led a study involving 1,000 patients with advanced lung cancer, analyzing tumors for 10 different mutations that drive the spread of the disease.
We had this vision that we could test the tumors of patients at the time they were diagnosed. We could test for 10 of these oncogenes that we know underlie lung cancer. We were able to find one of those driver oncogenes in 64% of the patients, and in 28% of the patients, we were able to choose a therapy based on that information.
Identifying those damaged genes would allow doctors to better target treatment. Dr. Criss said the testing is fast, accurate, and cost-effective. The results showed that patients whose driver oncogenes were specifically targeted lived on average a year longer than those who received standard chemotherapy. In addition, drugs directed at the damaged genes only cause fewer side effects. Dr. Criss said the results of the study will help treat people with all types of cancer as doctors learn more about genes that drive the disease. The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
To see video of this report, please log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And you can post your comments to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter. Our address there is at NowVOAShow.
Tomorrow way too far away, and we can't get back yesterday. But we young right now, we got right now, so get up right now.
There's a new movie out that deals with two very poignant subjects, cancer and love.
The film The Fault in Our Stars tells the story of two teenagers, Hazel Grace Lancaster and Augustus Waters, who meet in a cancer support group.
Hazel has thyroid cancer that has spread to her lungs, while Augustus, or Gus, as everybody calls him, had bone cancer that led to the amputation of one of his legs.
The two meet when Hazel's parents insist she attend the support group.
What's your name?
Hazel.
And what's your full name?
Hazel Grace Lancaster. Why are you looking at me like that?
Because you're beautiful.
Oh, my God.
Let's go watch a movie.
What?
Hmm?
Huh? I'm free later this week.
No, I mean now.
You could be an axe murderer.
There's always that possibility.
The movie is based on the hugely popular novel by author John Green.
At the film's premiere in New York, Green said he hopes audiences will see the movie as a love story and not just a story about kids with cancer.
All people, able-bodied or disabled, deserve love and deserve to be loved. All people can have rich, emotional, complex lives, and I think it's really, it's unfair to say that it's just a story about kids with cancer, because hopefully if we did our job, it's also a story about much, much more.
Shailene Woodley plays Hazel Grace, and she says that her focus was telling the story of the girl and her first love, not her disease.
I very eloquently say I did not play a advanced cancer patient. I played a young woman who happened to have cancer, but who was also having her first kiss, having sex for the first time, falling in love for the first time, like absorbing those delicious moments that we only are afforded when we're adolescents.
Ansel Elgort plays Gus. He says the story is more intense because of the character's disease, but all life is important.
I think the most important thing is what this movie says is not, oh, well, these sick people can die and teach healthy people a lesson. It's saying that, no, sick people are just as important as healthy people. All people are just as important as everyone else. And just because you're sick and might only live till 20 doesn't mean that you know, someone who lives to 100 is more important than you.
Nat Wolff plays Isaac. He says that playing the part was difficult because his character is experiencing real tragedy while being the comic relief in the story.
Yeah, it was a hard part. I mean, it seemed so easy when I first read it, and then it turned out to be probably the hardest part I played, just because it was, balancing the fact that he is going blind and that he's, like, getting dumped and that he's, you know, still got to be the levity of the movie and the comedy. And I guess the way I did that was just by making him a funny person, not having him be the butt of the joke.
The Fault in Our Stars also stars Sam Trammell and Willem Dafoe.
The movie is directed by Josh Boone, who directed 2012's Stuck in Love.
The movie features music by Ed Sheeran and Charlie XCX.
So, do you plan to see The Fault in Our Stars? Have you read the book?
Let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Our address there is at Now VOA Show. For George Boyce and his wife, a lifelong dream has become reality.
George and his wife, Eva Fallon, founded GreenStems, a nonprofit that promotes science and creativity.
They turned an empty store in downtown Greenbelt, Maryland, into a community clubhouse.
As Faisa El Masri and Faith Lapidus tell us, it's a space for people, especially kids, to work on science projects and hobbies.
From the outside, Club 125, named for its street address, looks like any other store in a shopping area. From inside, it is a science lab with dozens of computers, laptops, wires, light bulbs, screws, and more.
Our three core areas are robotics, microelectronics, and computer science.
George Boyce and his wife, Eva Fallon, who both work in internet technology, founded the club.
And it gives us an opportunity to introduce kids and their families and adults to science and technology. And it gives people an opportunity to work hands-on and learn some new stuff that they might not be able to learn in school, or as adults they don't have an opportunity to work with because they don't have the right resources.
School children come here with their teachers or parents.
I like science, but I like making robots better.
11-year-old Dinah Cohen is a homeschool student. With her father's help, she used the resources at Club 125 to make a robot in the shape of an elephant.
We wanted to make it move. I'd like to make the elephant work better.
Her mother and teacher, Leah Cohen, says visiting Club 125 is a great learning opportunity.
She comes here and has to solve a problem with her Lego robotics. Coming here is really great because it's a really diverse group of people. So, Dinah learns from kids who are younger than herself, and she learns how to work with kids that are older than herself. And she also works with the wide variety of adults that are in here, too.
That's exactly what George Boyce dreamed the creative space would provide.
We're actually open more hours and different hours from the library, so we're able to provide access to resources like our computer network and our laptop so that the kids can come in.
Boyce and Fallon transformed a dry cleaning store into the community club.
It's very hands-on, and it's also very self-directed.
Fallon says the club is a work in progress.
If someone's interested in something, we try and help them figure out how to learn about it and how to do something with it. Yes, there's some level of direction, but we really try and encourage them to puzzle it out on their own and then show us what they did.
And it's not only about science and technology.
We include some arts and crafts, predominantly because I'm a knitter. We have a popular event, Repair Cafe. Don't throw it away, repair it. So people bring in broken items and volunteers repair them. Or if they're not repairable, we take them to electronics recycling. But we do jewelry repair. We had bicycle repair, small appliances, some furniture repairs.
Volunteers like Wendy Cooler help run the club.
The space serves as something of a community living room. It's like an extension of my home. You know, it continues to challenge us to have better and more meaningful relationships with each other, to share skills and share food and share our lives with each other and help to raise each other's children.
Club 125, she says, defines what a community is, and in the process, promotes experimentation and curiosity. For writer Faiz El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
To see video of green stems, log on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And if you have any questions or comments, log on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Asia.
And you can also follow us on Twitter. Our address is at now VOA Show.
So, Aisha, you have a cell phone, right?
I have a cell phone. Of
yeah,
course.
You have a Samsung, Apple, what, you know?
An iPhone.
Okay. Do you have any games on it?
No.
No?
I had the Temple Run.
Yeah.
And then I deleted it.
You have a five-year-old son. You don't have any games on your phone?
No.
Really?
Okay. I downloaded Temple Run when it had just come out.
Right.
And I became too addicted to it.
Really?
Yes, for 6 months. And I made a real good score on that.
Yeah.
And I remember everybody, you know, who I would tell my score to, I don't remember how much it was. I mean, they were shocked.
They disliked you because you were good?
For 6 months, yes.
Yeah.
But my son became even better than that. He was only 4 years of age at that time.
Right.
And one day I put my foot down.
Yeah.
No more. I deleted it.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Did he cry?
No, I cried.
Everybody, it seems nowadays, has a cell phone, and the proliferation of cellular phones has meant a huge financial windfall for the folks who design those games that you and I get addicted to.
Experts estimate that revenue from these games could top $11 billion this year.
VOA's George Pootich gives us a look at the Electronic Entertainment Exhibition, known as E3, and at what could be coming to your phone.
Early computers were too slow to process the enormous quantity of data needed for realistic pictures, sound, and special effects. As the processors became faster and cheaper, manufacturers saw the potential for a large market and developed dedicated game consoles. Now, fast smartphones and other mobile devices have opened another segment of the market that is chipping away at the prestige of large companies. San Francisco-based App Annie is a private firm that analyzes the mobile gaming market. Company official Marco Sanchez says firms that develop games for mobile devices are making huge profits.
In fact, one company alone in some of the top 10 games are actually pulling in over $1 billion in revenues. So gaming from the mobile app perspective is a pretty serious thing, and there's some pretty serious revenues associated with it.
Now that business models have spread to several different platforms, upstart companies are reaching into all segments of the market and doing very well, says Yoshio Saki, senior vice president of the International Development Group.
The video games are not just about the console anymore. And you see a lot of cross-pollination and hybridization across, you know, you have Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo, you have EA, Activision, etc. But you also now have Wargaming and Riot Games making League of Legends, or mobile companies like King with Candy Crush, or Kabam or Supercell with Clash of Clans.
Many of the gaming companies rely on their devoted gamers for fresh ideas. Even those as young as 17-year-old Michael Simon from Peru. In a recent interview for Voice of America's Spanish service, Simon talked about his responsibilities as Facebook's youngest employee.
I will be working on a system called Parse, which is part of Facebook and works with many applications, and they all connect together through what Facebook does and what the company within Facebook, Parse, also does.
Parse software is designed to help others develop even more apps for mobile devices. George Pootich, VOA News, Washington.
So what do you think? What new games would you like to see on your mobile phone?
Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And we are also on Twitter. Our address there is at now VOA Show.
The Frameline San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival is the oldest ongoing and largest film exhibition dedicated to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues.
This year, a short film about gender roles in the Filipino-American community is set to play during the Homegrown program, which showcases the work of local San Franciscans.
Princesa is the story of Ray, a young Filipino-American father who struggles to understand why his 6-year-old son, Jojo, identifies more with the princess in his recalling of the Filipino folk dance, the singkil, rather than the prince in the story.
Jojo, stop. You can't be the princess.
Yes, I can. Watch me.
No, Jojo. I mean, you can't. Not the princess.
But why not?
Because you're a boy, Jojo.
But I want to be like Mommy. You don't think I'm pretty?
Of course you're pretty. I mean...
Ray, come on.
Throughout the 12-minute film, Ray must address his own ideas of masculinity as well as his role as a father.
Conrad Panganiban and Emmanuel Romero, along with Drew Stevens, are the three co-writers of Princesa, which was an all-volunteer project.
Panganiban and Romero, both Filipino-Americans living in San Francisco, spoke with VOA's Ashley Westerman about how they each drew from different experiences while writing the film.
Princesa co-writer Conrad Panganiban says he wanted to write from a Filipino father's standpoint and how one would react if his son was accused of being gay. He said he drew from his own experiences growing up dealing with the guy's guy mentality in the Filipino-American community, as well as seeing a family torn apart because a family member came out as gay.
I've seen the effects that it can have on families, and especially in a Filipino household where masculinity is still very respected and male gender roles are very put in a box. And what I wanted to do was to highlight this form of, you know, masculinity and what it can do to harm people, especially in this case, kids who are thought of as being gay and being ostracized by the community, and who would come to their defense as a father would.
Fellow co-writer Emmanuel Romero says even though he mostly drew from other people's experiences and stories dealing with LGBT issues, he also wanted to address questions kids may have. He says he has 3 nephews between the ages of 2 and 7 who are growing up in a world that is becoming more accepting towards the LGBT community.
That's great, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the bullies have gone away. And so, you know, they're young, and I don't know if they're going to have questions later on about their own sexual orientation or gender identity. But I would love for them to grow up in a world where they feel like it's safe to have those kinds of questions. And I feel like by working on a project like Princesa, hopefully I'm helping to contribute to a conversation.
The Philippines as a country is one of the most accepting of the LGBT community. It was recently ranked the 10th most gay-friendly country in a global survey and is considered the most gay-friendly nation in Asia. This is all despite the devout Roman Catholic majority in the Philippines, the only country other than the Vatican where divorce is illegal. Romero thinks it's important to increase the visibility of LGBT community issues both in the Philippines and in the U.S., and that Princesa is a part of that very important conversation.
In this movie, I feel like Ray doesn't necessarily have the answer about whether Jojo is or isn't transgender or gender nonconforming. The only thing that Ray does know is that he needs to love and support his child no matter what.
That was Emmanuel Romero and Conrad Panganiban, co-writers of the film Princesa, speaking with VOA's Ashley Westerman.
The film will be shown at the Frameline San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival on June 22nd.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Now.
If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard on our show, log on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
If you'd like to hear the program again, you can log on to our website, www.voanews.com/now. We're also on iTunes.
And we are on Twitter. Our address there is at Now VOA Show.
Patrice Martin produces our program.
The managing editor of VOA English is Diane Gao.
Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Aisha Khalid.
Join us again Monday for another edition of Now.